Welcome to the Bridge of Two podcast. Welcome to the Bridge of Two podcast, ladies and gentlemen.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
As always, honor spren.
Yes.
And dishonor spren.
Oh, are those a thing?
Spren of odium, maybe.
Void spren.
Yes. Oh.
I like dishonor spren. We should email Brandon Sanders and tell him we should change it to dishonor spren.
Still can be a dishonor spren sometimes. Your cat.
And she's a sweetheart, huh? What you're talking about.
Yeah. So, how are you doing?
I was about to ask you that. Come on now. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well. I'm just giddy.
Had a good couple weeks.
To be recording.
I am also excited to be recording.
Yeah, good couple weeks. I guess I'll talk about what I've actually been doing.
Yeah, anything new, anything fun, interesting? What worlds have you delved into?
Ooh.
You spelunker you into the art of sci-fi and fantasy.
Sci-fi spelunking, fantasy spelunking, sci-fi lunking, fantasy, anyway.
Stop combining things. One of them's going to sound weird, you just know it.
I know, that's why I stopped. I was like, no. We have to get this out of the way.
Now I'm thinking of words that are
funny. You're trying to think of how you could make it sound weird. Okay.
I've already found a few that sound... I won't say them. This is a family-friendly podcast.
It is. Safe for the little ears.
I think so.
Except for occasionally.
I think occasionally.
So, I finished Galactic Outlaws, the second book in Galaxy's Edge series.
Very nice, very nice.
Just the other night.
What'd you think?
I was on a long drive home from DeLand.
What are you doing in DeLand?
At that county council meeting.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that's where all that happens at.
Yeah. How appropriate, on the way home I listened to
The
Death of a Character. I won't say who, but...
In the beginning of a death of a lot of things.
Yeah, it seems like it. It seems like it. Things aren't going to go well for the galaxy.
It is a dumpster fire, so.
Sounds like it's going to get even more dumpster fiery. Some very old person, very old astronaut.
I actually don't remember, so that's okay. I'm glad I'm rereading. I'm really reading
this. He's going to be throwing gasoline on the galaxy, apparently.
As one does.
To save it, you know.
Spoilers, by the way. Spoilers.
I mean, that's, you know.
It's a very vague spoiler.
Yeah. It's a teaser.
There you go. Teaser. That's good. I like it. Teaser.
If you want to find out.
But you thought it was good? You excited to read more?
I did. Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting. You know, seeing more of Tyrus Rex in this one. You know, the epilogue the first book. That character just seemed super amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And to get a lot of viewpoint chapters from him in here, and a really good story, character arc for him in this one was very cool. I really enjoyed his character. He's kind of the grizzled, old general. He's like Pappy on steroids in the first book, which you didn't get to see much of Pappy in the first book, what he can do.
Which is crazy, thinking that Rex was once Pappy's...
LT,
right?
Yeah.
LT or captain or general or something like that.
It's LT. I just remember the epilogue, I'm calling him LT. No, you're right.
I think it was general. I think it was still general,
right,
to that point.
Yeah, you're right. It was general. Pappy was the LT I'm thinking of. He was the LT that smacked,
yes.
that had the sidebar like ripping into his throat or whatever.
Yes, 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 yes.
Tyrus Rex just has seen a lot of things, and he's trying to save this girl whose father was killed, who wants revenge, and she wants to go down the same road he went, and he's like, no, don't. Bad idea. But then he doesn't really know, because of who he is, he doesn't really know how to save someone from that. He doesn't know how to pull someone back from that. And so, you know, that's just an interesting dynamic between him and that girl, that little girl. And then...
You have my favorite character of all time.
Keel.
Love Captain
Keel.
And Ravi.
Ravi. Very fun duo there.
I love all the times that Ravi's just like 14%.
Yes.
Like,
yeah, he says the percentage.
89%. Like,
yeah, he actually had like a line that was a little near the end that was a little, I don't want to say it wasn't tear jerking, but it was like a little, mm-hmm. a little twinge of emotion there whenever he says, you know, something like 4%.
But
there's still hope or something.
Listening through it again too, like I'm picking up a lot more things that I didn't pick up on the first time because I kind of blasted through those when I read them. But like I listen to it again, it's just like there's a lot of things, like the way that they write is just like they just write things in that at first seem like just mistakes, like that it just doesn't make sense in the galaxy or doesn't make sense in the story, but like it ends up coming together,
like foreshadowing type stuff
to an extent. But like, so like an example, like Tyrus Rex, like you know about him mm-hmm. and his past and everything like that, but the way that they write, like you would assume after the epilogue that Tyrus Rex is dead.
Yeah.
And then you start the book off 10 years later or something like that.
Yeah.
And Tyrus Rex is still alive. And he just makes certain comments and he just does certain things and people say certain things that are just like, there's no way that this is like legit. Like, this is just an accident. Same thing with Ravi. I've just read a thing and you won't know about it right now, but you'll probably find out a little bit later on. But like, there's just some things that happen that like when you read it, you're like, there's no way. Like, this doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And then like, even Keel makes some comments about like stuff with Ravi that you're like, that doesn't make any sense, you know?
Yeah.
But it actually does all connect. I don't know, the way they write it, like they write things expecting you to just be like, just accept it. And I kind of like that. But they do explain it later on. It's kind of interesting.
I love the author, I guess it's two guys that have written these books. I love how they, I don't know if it's the voice of the author is so, I don't know if melodramatic's the right word. Like, it's just very serious, very dramatic about, they'll just say lines like, the galaxy is a dumpster fire, you know, or a little girl... shouldn't have to mm-hmm. a little girl asking questions she shouldn't have to ask on the edge of the galaxy, you know, like mm-hmm. stuff like that that's kind of like overly dramatic, but it really works mm-hmm. in this book mm-hmm. in this series, you know, something that could come off as almost cheesy, but because of just the world that,
and I also just think that's what they're going for.
Right, absolutely.
It's not just like something they're, like, it's different. There's a difference too between cheesiness where like it's accidentally cheesy and then other where it's intentional. They're intentionally like doing this. Like they have intentionally pretty much basically have like stated like this is like Star Wars, like they're just influenced by Star Wars a lot, so this is why it's heavily influenced, you know.
Well, and it's cheesy. If you buy into it, if you read it and you get kind of immersed in the world and you buy into it, then it's exactly the right tone.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
You know, it strikes the exact right tone. So
and it's exactly what they're going for.
And but I just, there'll just be lines like that that you'll just, you know, listen to and you're like, that line can't work in just anything. It can work here, but it can't just work in anything.
Yeah.
You know, but Captain Keel was really cool. There's a big twist with him, pretty big twist with him, I think. My brother-in-law was reading it, and he was like, "You didn't see that? You didn't see that coming?" I could tell. Like he's read a lot of like sci-fi, mm-hmm. especially fantasy, and he just sees things coming a mile away.
I'm pretty sure my first time reading it, I didn't see it until the end, which is insane because there's a lot. Reading through it now, I'm like, there's a lot of hints to it.
Yeah,
but I don't remember realizing that the twist until the end. Right. For some reason. And like I said, probably
there is a very blatant thing said at the end, but there's also a little over midway through, there's like a statement about Captain Keel putting on some armor and alluding to him maybe being another character. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that was kind of hard. That kind of blew me away a little bit too, because that character, the way that character talks and the way you met, especially in the
very different from the first book compared to the second book.
Right. You're like, wait, that's him?
And that's why I think when I was reading through the first time I like didn't catch on, because it just, and I wasn't even listening to the audiobook, I was actually reading it, and the way even reading it, like he's the character is a very different tone than what I'm used to with how that character was portrayed,
right?
I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about his character going forward, because he's got an interesting little storyline of going on as the books progress. And I think the third book, part of it takes place at the same time as book one.
Yeah, my brother-in-law said that some of the third book is like happening at the same time. So, which is interesting. Yeah, we'll have to talk. We'll have to do an episode.
Yeah.
Once you finish it and just get into it, maybe full spoiler it, and talk about it, because I definitely have more thoughts on his character and you know, speculating and stuff. I also watched a few episodes of Star Wars Visions that just dropped.
Did.
Yesterday. 22nd September. And I've been enjoying it. It's different, but it's aiming to be different. It's not canon. It's not really even trying to fit into any canon.
Yeah.
It's just trying to take Star Wars concepts and, you know, do a spin on them and in an anime, some type of, you know, anime style animation. And the first episode's cool. I was thinking because the inspiration for Star Wars, some of the inspiration came from a Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
And so to have it like a samurai setting.
I really liked that, the whole samurai setting in that, because I've watched the first episode. Right. I really liked that setting in the first one. It was just, yeah, definitely felt very...
And a very samurai story, too.
Yeah, oh,
like
yeah.
A, you know, wandering sort of samurai-type character in there. So that was a fun one. And they're all very short, so they're very easy to just let it keep rolling if you have the time. So I watched three. The second one was good. It was definitely different, a whole different tone from the first
one. Yeah, I'm like halfway through the second one, and I already could tell it's just a completely different tone.
I love the art style in the second one, like the just how rich the colors were and everything.
That's what's cool about it too, is it's done by different companies.
Every like, single one is a different studio.
Or I think two companies do
more than one.
More than one.
Yeah, I think it's there's like seven studios, but there's like ten
seven
episodes.
Studios. Like yeah, seven or eight studios and 10 episodes. But I think that's cool. They just kind of gave these guys free reign to kind of do their thing, and it's real. I just like as an art person and as a drawer. I really like the watching the animation and how they're making it. Like that first one's animation is also obviously very different from the second one. And it's just cool to see. I always enjoy seeing how different people do it, and if it's in the Star Wars concept, I'm obviously gonna love it. So
right.
So I'm enjoying it. I've watched the first one. I've enjoyed it so far. And the half the second one.
Let me know when you get to the third episode, because that one is almost like a what if episode. It's not because it's very, you know, because it's once again not trying to fit into any canon. It's not like saying everything's the same except if we just change this one thing. It's not doing that. You know, it's like, to me, it seems like it's a different spin on Luke and Leia. They're not named Luke and Leia, but when you watch it, it's very clear. It's like a spin on the idea of twins, force sensitive twins, you know. That one was really wild, like anime wild, which now think the more I think about it, I really love it.
That's a big reason why I like anime. It's unapologetically over the top.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of how I view, and that's I think why I like episode 9 a little bit more than others, is I view it as just a live action anime, because it's just very anime with like just over the top with everything. And if I view it that way, it's just like it's enjoyable. It's not like a best movie, but it's enjoyable.
Yeah, that's a good point. I could totally imagine
freaking giant shooting giant lightning in the space that disrupts all the ships. That is the most anime thing in the world.
Absolutely.
Like, strike me down and you will become all the Sith. Like, these are just straight. JJ was just like, what anime can I make this like, you know? Or how much like anime can I make this, you know? So that's why, you know.
Yeah.
I do like anime for that reason. Unapologetically over the top. Almost right. Like, oh, so many animes are like that. And it's great.
And just the emotion, like the emotion of the characters, just at a constant flux of from one end to another. And, but it was definitely a fun one. Probably my favorite so far.
I think we've talked about before. There's like very few things that have made me like choke up a little bit during like a book or a movie. I think Rhythm of War was one. Episode 3 is one.
Lord of the Rings, and then
Lord of the Rings, sort of not as bad as the other two, but then like there's definitely. I'm trying to think of what.
There's a fourth?
Yes, but I cannot remember it now. But it's an anime. It was from an anime. Not that it made me choked up, but like it definitely made me feel like emotions. I cannot remember what anime it was, though, to save my life. But that was one of them, too.
Juwoo, if you're listening and you know
the answer. I don't think he knows either.
Then email bridgeof2@gmail.com.
Shout out to Jiwoo again.
Shout out to Jiwoo.
I don't think he knows, because I don't. Actually, shout out to Jiwoo, because you haven't texted me in, like, months.
Yeah. If you listen to this, text me, too.
Yeah, sure.
Text me first.
Cool. Well, that sounds like fun. Sounds like you've been had a, you know, anything else you got going on you've been doing?
I've been writing, but...
Ooh. Ooh. Ooh, what are you writing? More your book?
Yeah. Nice. I mean, it's basically working on a revision, the revision of what I already have.
I can't wait to be able to read it.
What I'm basically having to look at now is, like, the things that, you know, just gaping holes that have to be filled for things to make sense. And looking at, there's, like, sections where I rewrote a scene multiple times, and I was trying different things, and then trying to make that into one coherent scene. So that's something cool. I was working on recently, which was hard, because I was like, okay, I have to kind of start rewriting this, and then I can fill in what fits, take what fits from what I've already written, but I kind of have to start, because I needed to remove a character from this scene, because I changed how I want that character to interact with the main character.
Is it hard to do, to kind of just, like, restart, or to, like, get rid of the character?
It is. I mean, the character's still going to be around, but he's just changing his, well, how he's going to be in the story. And so, yeah, it is hard, because it's like you're constantly changing. The characters are constantly changing. And so you kind of have to give up to make the story work, to make it better, to make it be what it needs to be. You have to give up what a character, you know, that you imagine that character, and kind of
make him fit with the story.
Make him fit in a different way. And
well, it's a good thing to be able to do, though, because, like, I mean, same thing with art. Like, sometimes you'll be doing a drawing and you're like, this isn't working, and you just have to erase the whole thing, or erase the whole section. You know, I've done that with some stuff, and it's hard to do for me, because if I get started, I'm like, no, I must finish, because I got started. This is putting so much work into it. It's like, well, don't be so married to your idea.
Right.
Be willing to change it up if need be.
Right. Yeah, sometimes you'll take more time by trying to
make this fit.
To fit in something that just isn't fitting with, because at the time maybe it worked, but then as the stuff grew up around it doesn't work, you know. So you have to sometimes be willing to just be like, okay, rewrite this scene.
Nice. So,
but
is your short story out there in the ether?
It's out there on a website from whenever I entered it into the contest. So it's out there, published there. You mean, like, out there to, like, purchase or something?
No, just, like, is it out there, like, to be read?
Yeah,
like,
it is
people
out there.
Can people go, like, look it up and read it if they want
to?
Yeah,
they absolutely can. And if people are interested, you know, I could definitely put a link out there.
Be on the lookout for that, guys. I've read it. It's a good short story.
Yeah, there's a
I actually have, it's in an anthology book, and I have that anthology book sitting up with my Brandon Sanderson books, the only other book that will ever sit with Brandon Sanderson, so you better, that means a lot.
Maybe someday that can be replaced by the actual
it will.
Novel. I'm
going to have a whole shelf devoted to Josh Allred. What are you talking about?
That'd be cool. I guess start with get this first one done. But what about you? What have you been up to?
Same old, you know. A lot of work. I mean, a lot of school and work, as always. Started up... There's so many books. I don't even know if I'm halfway or not, but the New Jedi Order series...
Mm.
I'm like the seventh or eighth book in.
Okay. Out of how many?
I think I want to say there's almost like 20. There's a lot. Wow. There's a lot. And they're all written by the Death and Offer authors and stuff like that. It's, you know, they're kind of split into like parts, like two, like the book I'm on right now has two parts to it. There's a book one and a book two.
Okay.
And they kind of follow a storyline, but all of them follow an overarching storyline.
Now, that's not the series that ends with like Jaqen and Jaina and...
No. It is the beginning... It ends with the beginning of that series.
Okay.
What's that series called? I think I know what you're talking about. Oh, crap. I could tell you. I have a few of them on my bookshelf. I don't remember exactly what the series is called.
Okay.
But that series takes place right after the New Jedi Order series.
It's in the back. It's like in the back of my, rolling around in the back of my mind. It might come to the surface here.
Yeah. So I've been reading that. That's been fun. I picked that because it's been like almost 2 years since I've dropped off on it.
Yeah.
And they're easy books to read. And so I don't have to like, it's not like I'm reading Stormlight Archive. Like I can do schoolwork, but then also take 30 minutes to read a few pages or a few chapters or whatever.
Cause there you can get through.
And it's enjoyable. Faster. I'm kind of back on a Star Wars kick a little bit. And I love that. That story is, all those books that I've read so far for that has been real, have been great. I mean, like, I some people don't like it, and I can understand why, because it's very weird with the Star Wars universe to an extent. But I love it, and I think it's great. I think it's very emotionally, there's a lot of emotional things happening. I mean, it just, like, if you don't know what the New Jedi Order is, it kind of takes place, I don't remember how long, but pretty far after, a decent bit after the Battle of,
Yavin.
Yavin? No, yes. Even the Battle of, even after the Battle of Endor, the New Republic is a thing.
Mm.
Luke has started his New Jedi Order. Jaqen and Janna, which are Han and Leia's children, and the old, you know, legends, what I consider true canon. they're grown, they're grown up. They're like 18, I think, something like that. They're both Jedi, Jedi. Anakin is the third child, and he's trained under.
I forgot there was an Anakin. Mm-hmm. That's cool.
But so they're in it.
Shout
but then
out
you
to
have,
Anakin.
Exactly. So they have like an alien species actually come from outside of the galaxy.
Is that the Yuuzhan
Vong? The Yuuzhan Vong, and they're like devoid of the Force, like they can't be felt in the Force.
Oh.
They're like unaffected by the Force. And basically this, kind of the premise is they just run train on the galaxy, like they're just taking planet over planet after planet. They're like a very warlike society, very, you know, pain and killing and everything like that, and showing strength. And if you can imagine, like, it's definitely, in my opinion, one of the more darker storylines in Star Wars. Take that for what you will. I mean, Anakin killing kids is pretty dark, but like, this is a pretty dark storyline. I mean, read the first book and you'll know what I'm
talking
about. Darker. You'll read the first book and you'll know what I'm talking about.
Okay. What's the first book called?
Ooh. Yeah. It's written by R.A. Salvatore. It's written by R.A. Salvatore.
What? R.A. Salvatore?
I know, right? Hold up. I have it on my phone. It's written by R.A. Salvatore, the first book.
I did not know.
And he does something insane in it.
As only R.A. Salvatore can.
Mm-hmm. So give it a read if you like Star Wars and are curious. It is called Vector Prime.
Okay. Now I want to read it.
And so it's good. If you read the first book, by the end of it, you'll probably want to keep reading. That was kind of how it was. My dad told me about it when I first started it, and I was like, I'll check it out.
What happened?
No, he just told me about the book.
Okay.
He's like, it's really good. And I knew R.A. Salvatore because I've read his other books.
Okay.
And I was like, I'll give it a check out. And yeah, it was awesome. So give it a read. And it just continues on. I mean, things are just going from bad to worse. I think more things happen. Like I said, things that happen in this series lead to what happened with Jaqen and Janna in that next series.
I think I remember what that series was called. It's called Legacy of the Force.
Yes. No. Yeah, maybe. I don't think so.
No?
I think Legacy of the Force actually comes after.
Really? Or was that a book in the series, maybe?
I can actually probably find out for you in like 5 seconds.
I just remember when those books were coming out. I think Karen Travis wrote one.
She wrote three, I think.
Yeah. I think she wrote like a pretty pivotal book in that series, like near the end of that series.
You know who's in that series, right?
Who's in it?
Yeah, if you've read Republic Commando.
Oh, yeah. Is it one of the Nulls? Because
you're right. It is Legacy of the Force. I was thinking Fate of the Jedi.
Boom.
Look at you go.
Hey, I got some. I don't know what I got. I'm looking for the word.
But yeah. So anyway, long story short, it's fun. Give it a read. Definitely check it out. I'm on book. I can't tell you what book I'm on. I'm on book 7. I'm on book 7 of like 20.
35.
I think like 20.
Okay.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
Can you imagine Brandon Sanderson is going to write
all of them,
like more books than that, and how long he writes books? Oh wow. Like his books.
Yeah, those books are super long. So yeah, so that's been fun. That's I started that like a week ago. Playing my games, you know. Still playing Star Wars The Old Republic on my Sith. That's just been, I can go jump on that for like an hour or two. It's, my wife's at work. That's been fun. I haven't played as much Mass Effect this week just because the last 2 weeks haven't sat down and played it. I'm on the second one though, and that's game's always fun.
Is there anything coming out soon we need to talk about? I remember we talked about Knights of the Old Republic remake last time, and since then there's been a teaser, which was a very short teaser.
Oh yeah, it's been actually like officially announced.
But it was officially announced, short teaser, some more stuff, a little bit more stuff.
I'm hesitant about it.
Yeah,
which I've mentioned to you, just because I've heard that
You weren't last time we talked.
Yes.
I was the hesitant.
This time I'm a little hesitant because I've heard that the company, I think it's Aspyr that's doing it. Uh-huh. The same company that's remade all the Star Wars games. Like, if you have a Star Wars game on the Switch, like Republic Commando, I think Aspyr is when they remade it. Knights of the Republic on the phone was remade by
Right.
Okay. Not remade, but like remastered. Ported for by Aspyr. But I heard they're kind of doing like a from the ground up type of thing.
Yeah. That's fine.
But if they start changing the story to fit with canon or start changing the story,
yeah.
The game has already got such a great story. It's going to be.
To the average mind, to the a mind of common sense, that you have something here that, sure, you know, update the like combat systems, mm-hmm. update. This, that, and the other. Maybe flesh out certain things a little more.
Heck, in the story. You don't necessarily need to flesh out the maybe make the combat system like Dragon Age Origins, and then just revamp the graphics. And I think you would sell so many copies.
Yeah, because I just know that if they're gonna invest a lot of money in it to remake it, then they're gonna put their mark on it as far as the story goes. But
and that's fine. But it's just got such a good story.
Well, I think they could still keep the tent poles of the story.
We'll see what happens.
You know, the core pieces of the story and still not mess it up. I think that's possible.
We'll see. I mean, we'll see. It definitely depends. I'm curious and I'll get it and play. Well, I'll get it if I have a PS5.
Yeah.
Or
I heard they announced it was going to be a PC.
Yeah, I'm trying to decide. But it was going to be released on other consoles later on. It's specifically a launch exclusive to PS5. But I don't even know if my PC can run it, so I don't
think that'll give PC. Give you if for me with a PC, give me time to let the dust settle and see what what people are saying about it before I throw $60
at it. Oh, there is a new Star Wars game that got announced too. Did you hear about this one? Oh, what's it called? Star Wars Hunters.
Oh yes.
It looks very
Hunters.
Yeah,
it looks like it's a
almost Overwatchy.
Yeah, there's like it's like a team based. Some kind of team-based.
But it's got, like, nothing to do with, like, any of the mainline. Like, none of the characters or anyone we've ever met before. I mean, it's very... It looks interesting. I'm going to play it. It's on the Switch, and I'll definitely... I think it's going to be on the Switch. Okay. And I will 100% get on the Switch, and I'll play it. It looks fun. I liked Overwatch when it came out.
Yeah.
For a little bit. So, into Star Wars, I mean, I'll get it and play it. I'm not, like, extremely excited about it, but it looked cool.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? It looked cool.
I think a couple other things were... There are other things that are, like... on the fringes of being announced, I've heard, like, other single-player Star Wars games. I know Jedi Fallen Order 2 is in the works. That's already been announced. I'm trying to think of any other games or anything that's coming out that I can think of.
There's a Gollum game coming out?
Yes, I did.
Don't know what to think about that.
Very, very stealthy game, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I personally probably won't get it unless I hear good things about it.
I mean, I'm sure at some point I'll play it.
Maybe when it goes on sale.
Because... Unless I just hear it's just dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of doubt that it's going to be dreadful, but is it going to be weird playing as Gollum? Like, what are you going to be doing?
It'll be interesting. I don't know. I'll be curious. It'll definitely going to be a stealth game into Mordor for sure.
For some reason.
I guess we'll find out as we get closer.
Tortured.
Lord of the Rings also just released a new iPhone game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I picked it up. I haven't played it yet. It's like a Clash of Clans type of game. I think.
Yeah, it's not gonna be anything. I'm gonna.
I'm gonna check it out just to check it out because why not?
Okay.
But we'll see.
Maybe we should both check it out and we should talk about it. And okay. We could, sure. You know, if it's bad, we can just rake it over the coals.
Sounds good to me. We'll let everybody know next episode.
It's probably if it's like any of those types of games, it's gonna be very. Cash grab, you know, like just really want to get you to buy all the 99-cent $5 packs, you know. Yeah.
But
quicker.
Yeah, but other than that, I mean, not much else is going on. There's nothing I can think of as well that like I'm like super hyped for as far as video games go, or even TV shows for that matter, or movies.
Wheel of Time show comes out in November.
Yes, and, that's true.
That's something I'm now just remembering. I want to finish the first. I've not finished the first book in that series, The Eye of the World. And I'd like to finish that and check the show out.
It's a good book. Good series.
Brandon Sanderson has been, and Brandon Sanderson and the Robert Jordan's wife have been consulting on it. And Brandon Sanderson said on his one of his live streams recently, he said he, you know, he doesn't really like to talk about it too much. He just likes to, you know, mm-hmm. sit back. But he did say he thinks it's going to be a good show. He said there's an episode he thinks is a 10 out of 10 script wise. Like, he was read the scripts and stuff.
Well, I'm excited for that.
So, that could be good. Could be not good.
We'll see. But yeah, I'm excited for that. I've also done a little bit of writing. Some world building.
I've been happy to see you get the bug.
Yep. So, mine will be different than Josh's. I'm not going to write a book. I'm going to try and make it more comic book-wise. Use some of my art. But that's... No one expect that anytime soon. It's gonna be a while, because I gotta get my drawing skills up a little bit more.
Well, you got time, because you've got to work on the story too. So
yes, so that's kind of why that's why I'm starting now too. As I'm working on my art skills and then also building up the story.
Yeah, just keep working on it. Keep working at it. I mean, I've been working at what I'm working on for several years, but whenever I look back. Sometimes it'll feel like I've not made any progress, and then I'll look back to what stuff from a year ago or whatever and realize...
You've made a lot of progress.
There's a lot. I've made a lot of progress, actually.
Inktober is about to start up.
Yeah.
I think I'm actually going to try and do it, and this will be the first year that I've, like...
Are you going to do Cosmere?
I'm going to do the one that you sent me, that Cosmere. Okay. I said I'm going to put my own little spin on it.
Do it.
I think I'm gonna join two things together with my artwork.
I'm going to bug you about it.
Go do it.
Until it really starts to feel like I might be annoying you, and then I'll stop.
Do it.
So I'm not that confrontational.
But yeah, I think I might try and put my own little spin on it. I mean, I'm going to do that Cosmere one that you sent me, but I'm going to put my own little spin on it and see.
Okay.
Maybe I'm going to combine two. I think I'm going to do a Stormlight Star Wars crossover. Okay. Obviously.
Kind of like...
But I've already got a few
ideas. Kind of like the guy who does the Lord of the Rings mm-hmm. Star Wars crossovers?
To an extent, yeah. Maybe not as serious as him, because he's just... That guy's amazing.
Well, in Inktober, you have to kind of...
I don't have a long time to do art.
Right.
I got a day.
You got to do it every day.
It's going to be kind of scratchy, pretty not great. But I have a few... Already, looking at some of the prompts, I've already got a few ideas for things, and that's what kind of got me on the thought of. Maybe I'll cross those over. So, but yeah, other than that, that's pretty much what I've been up to.
Nice. Well, do we want to talk about the D&D? Last D&D session?
Yeah, we can go over real quick. I'm just trying to think. My brain blinked there for a minute.
So the last one we left off on was...
In that little tower.
Oh, it ended with the key.
The key and the statue disappearing.
Yeah, so you guys were in the tower that looked like it was like Mind Flayer worship place, and you... Got poisoned and opened the key hole. And what'd you do? What happened next?
Obviously, we barged into a door.
Yeah. Well, there's like a hidden room, right?
I thought there was a door sitting right there.
Well, you opened the door and then
we opened the door and it was like a room full of like crates and shelves like and that. And we did find a hidden door.
Yeah.
And that hidden door led a little bit, led into like a tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And in that tunnel we heard. Munching? Like we heard like something like we
well,
heard
there something. there was a pool, bubbling pool
off to the right,
and then to the left you heard some feasting,
and we turned over and it was just this disgusting monster eating a headless person.
Yeah, took him out pretty quick, but then
he was easy, and I just my character decided he wanted to go inspect the pool,
the bubbling pool in the Mind Flayer temple.
Mm-hmm. Bubbling pool in the Mind Flayer temple, and of course this is the one time I'm going to roll really crappy on my dex, even though I have really high dex.
I think I said that there was like a thing swimming around, like lots of things.
Yeah, and I looked closer.
Got closer, and then it was basically a Mind Flayer tadpole like jumped out of the water to try and turn him into a Mind Flayer.
Failed. And then someone saved me.
You failed, and then Caleb punched your face.
That's right. Got on my face, and Caleb punched it.
And smashed it on your face.
That's right. That's right. That so funny. Then I think we had Steven's character throw a fireball at it.
And then, yeah, Steven's character was like, I'm going to try to kill all of them. Only what, I think, yeah, what I forget what, if it was fire or ice, but he tried to...
I think it was fire.
He tried to do it, and you're in a tunnel underground, so there's a lot sound happens.
Yeah, this attracted a lot of people.
So it attracted everyone that I had, like, put throughout that little... prison area you guys got to later all
of
came.
Course
so you had to fight them all at once,
and we handled them expertly.
How many was it total? I think it was 11 enemies total, maybe.
I thought it was a little more than that. I thought it was like four.
It was four and four and then three, so I think.
Oh, okay, so yeah, 11,
or maybe two. So maybe it may have only been 10, because I think there was three of the Grimlocks, the creatures from the creature you killed at the beginning was one of them, and then there were two more.
Yes.
And then eight soldiers or thugs or whatever.
Anyway, we destroyed them pretty handily.
You did. I wasn't trying. I wanted there to be some consequences
for our stupid actions.
But I, at the same time,
didn't want to murder us.
Yeah, I just wasn't, like, trying to throw really hard, because it was the beginning, it was kind of the beginning of the session, didn't want the whole session to be, like, a really hard combat. I want you guys to get a little further, so.
Well, I think after that, we ended up walking down the hallway, inspecting a little bit further, found a hallway that, like, ended at a dead end, and there was a rug there.
Yeah.
I think I rolled, like, a nat 20 and inspected, found a, was it a trap door that was locked, or was it just, like, a...
boarded up hole.
So we smashed it, threw a light thing down there, saw it was very deep, and then completely ignored it.
We're like, no, we're not going down there.
And went further into the structure that we are currently in.
Yeah.
Where we found prison cells with all the missing people from the villages.
Right.
Including the guy's son that was bugging us the first episode or first session.
Right.
They were Steven and Caleb were talking with them, trying to figure stuff out from them. Come to find out what they were like, they wanted to be like, they had like led, like they were led there by something.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found out like a person was getting taken like once a week or something like that, and they wouldn't see him again, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
Including the king, right?
No, there was the prince.
The prince. And
I don't remember if I told you that or if it was supposed to be. I think you told us. Okay.
I don't remember. But anyway, I think the prince was taken. I think she kind of told us, maybe. Yeah. I don't remember. Anyway.
The character, or the NPC.
Steph and I's character went and inspected another door further down, because that's the door they said that they take them into.
Bring now where it left off.
Yes, and then we broke in. Did I pick the lock or did she pick the lock?
She picked the lock. You were about to, and then she, like, shooed you off,
basically. Went in there. We saw a doctor scientist thing and one of the illithids on a table unconscious,
like a converted illithid person, like a mind flayer. Someone had been, you know, turned into a mind flayer, but they're unconscious laying on a table.
So then we learned from the doctor that they were turning these people into illithids, and for Lord, what was the Lord
illithid's name? Lord Zelix, I think.
Zelix, something along those lines. I have it on my iPad. Lord Zelix, and he was doing it because I guess he was... I don't actually know if we ever got a reason why yet.
Why he was doing what he was doing?
I don't...
I think it was about... I think the scientist said something about him, you know, saving the race.
That's right.
Saving their people. So something's going on there. And then you were like walking over. Mm-hmm. Your character is... I walk over.
I was being very
intimidating. I draw a knife and I walk over. And he's like, don't do it.
And
I pull the knife out. And then he's like, don't. Stop. And then Intellect Devourer, which is basically a brain with arms and legs.
That's right.
That can get in your head and eat your brain and take over your body. Jumped out of the...
doctor guy.
Of the doctor... So he was clearly being controlled by this thing to attack Jeremiah's character.
And just like with the tadpole pool, I rolled like dirt.
And he failed that roll, which he took like psychic damage.
And I lost something, right?
Oh, you're going to be something for the rest of the day until you long rest or something.
Yeah, something like that. Like, I got confused. I'm pretty sure I have it down. I don't remember what it is.
Yeah, and that fight did not end. That's where we ended the night.
Mm-hmm. So I had it right there.
Have to see if anyone's brain gets eaten in the next session.
It'll probably be mine. Unless I'm rolling better. But yeah, so excited to see where that's going to continue to go. Learned about this new Lord guy, and did the Githyanki seem to be behind? Not the Githyanki. I don't like why I keep calling him that. The Illithid.
Right.
Are behind the disappearance of the people, it seems like. So that'll be interesting. I'm excited. We'll hear more next episode, so stay tuned.
Stay tuned on the next episode of Bridge of Dungeons.
Dungeon of Bridges. Dungeons of Two.
See you in the dungeon. All right. Well, should we break and then we'll come back and do Return of the King?
Let's do it.
Welcome back.
Psychopomp.
From your break. Hope you all did what you needed to do. Came back.
Even though your break was probably like 3 seconds because just cut right into this.
All right, so we're gonna go ahead and open these up.
I want to read it first.
Okay.
Psychopomp is a Belgian-style mead brewed with European cherries at high temperatures to create a tart, full-bodied mead. Named after the beings that bring those from the land of the living to the land of the dead, and is extremely popular in both realms. Havoc Mead, a Psychopomp sour cherry mead. That sounds amazing.
I'm a little worried about the tart. I don't necessarily always love tart stuff, but you ready to try this? Get a little sniffy.
Let's do it. Ready?
Not what you're expecting.
Still smooth, like every other one of their drinks so far.
The sweetness is a lot more clamped down. When you think cherry, you think sweet because it's fruit, and you definitely there's
sour too.
There's definitely cherry taste, a little bit of tart. A lot lighter on the carbonation,
yes,
than I expected.
Hmm.
I think that just varies from batch to batch. I think it's something they're not.
It's good. The aftertaste is a little meh, but the drink itself is good.
It's definitely not hard to session. Is that the right term? You know, like, it's easy to come back for another drink, for another swig, sip.
Yeah, it's good. I enjoy it.
I don't think it's bad. It's just different.
Havoc Mead, Psychopomp, Sour Cherry Mead.
Yeah, so this is the same people, Grunfell. They did they have a spinoff, so that the Havoc Mead is like, they just try different things, you know, a little more outside the box, I guess.
About it. I like it. Cool. Delicious.
Thank you, Havoc Mead.
Yes, much delicious. Making great mead, as always.
All right. So, Return of the Friggin' King.
Part 2.
Part 2. Episode, or a movie so nice, we had to talk about it twice.
Yes.
It's the only time we'll ever talk about this movie.
It will never be mentioned again in the entirety of the podcast. You all can hold us to that. If we talk about it again, you can sue us. Please don't actually sue us. We'll talk about it again.
Yeah. Cannot be helped. So, yeah, so last time we talked about all the characters minus Frodo and Sam.
Yes.
You know, basically that storyline, all those characters' storylines come together in Gondor because they're all fighting together against the forces of Sauron, trying to hang on, hoping Frodo is going to somehow come through. And then they get to the Black Gate, or they go to the Black Gate to distract Sauron so that if Frodo's still in there, that he doesn't have a whole army of orcs in between him and Mount Doom.
Yes.
Which is kind of crazy.
Kind of.
They literally let them all get... They let the forces of Sauron completely surround them. That's something I always think about when they're charging. It's like, yeah, you're charging in one direction, but...
They're surrounding you.
They're surrounded. Like,
that whole situation, you know, is just...
Tactically not great.
Yeah, tactically plan. Just not good at all.
Yeah. It was just... They just threw all their chips in. You know, they just said... Either we're all going to go out in a blaze of glory, or, you know, something's going to happen with Frodo.
Well, I mean, Aragorn, even going in, Aragorn knew, like, we're doing this doing this to take, hopefully take some eyes off of Frodo so he can go do his thing.
Yeah.
You know, all, totally banking on the fact that Frodo's still alive. Like, they don't even, I mean, the last they heard was from Faramir.
They knew, they knew he was going to make, he was pretty close to making an end to Mordor because he was taking.
Yeah, they still didn't know that he was in there, pass, how close he was, if he was even still alive after the 2 days, you know.
So
I saw him.
So it ended, we ended with, you know, Aragorn's statement, he said, for Frodo, and they charged. Now let's
flash cut.
Let's rewind back a little bit and just talk about where Frodo and Sam kind of start in Return of the King. In the Two Towers, they are making their way. They're having a really tough time.
Making my way downtown, walking. I'm sure I can make
somehow them. Like Lord of the Ringsify that.
Mordor's to the east.
Yeah.
Making my way down east.
Here comes Smeagol. So
walking slow. But look at those dark clouds. I can't. Give me time.
So the Gollum has his own designs. He's been trying to
sorry. I'm back on track. I'm sorry. Continue.
Gollum's been trying to get to them and get the ring back. Can't let it go.
No.
And
the draw of the ring, it drives people insane.
Yeah, and so he catches up to him. They subdue him, basically make him promise. He basically says, he offers up his services so that I can help you get into Mordor if you let me live. And they're kind of like desperate because they've gotten lost. They don't really know which way they're going. They don't know how they're going to get into Mordor. It's a very abstract concept when you think about it.
Yeah,
it's like we need to get into Mordor and throw the ring in the Mount Doom. And then you get separated from everybody, and it's like, how are we actually going to do that?
I mean, it's journey before destination, man.
There you go. Comes first.
It's about the journey, not the destination.
That's right. So they get up to a point where, in the movie especially, they really play on the Smeagol Gollum personas as, like, split personalities. I feel like it was a little more subtle in the book, but definitely was there. It was just a little more subtle. I think they indicated it by the color of the eyes of Smeagol, like pale eyes or green eyes. There's like a green light that would come into his eyes when he was Gollum or whatever.
I like that little mix too. It's interesting.
Yeah. So they kind of got Smeagol on their side, and he kind of swore off Gollum, which was like, in the movie, it was like he was headed towards a redemption arc.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think the Two Towers made Gollum like he was a really fan favorite after that movie.
I believe it.
People really liked Gollum. He became a huge icon of a character. The way he talked and his...
Well, Andy Serkis did a fantastic job.
He really did, so, yeah.
I mean, that definitely helps.
I mean, they really did, you know, try to build in this sympathy for him.
You know. Just kind of like Frodo, you do feel sympathetic for him, you know? I mean, he is...
Which is very important.
Is understanding the story, especially from Frodo's point of view, who is currently, you know, has the ring and understands its draw. I mean, you can understand why it feels sympathetic for him because it has, you know, riddled his mind. And
yeah.
I mean, it basically created this whole new persona that is driven by the ring, you know. Yeah. And so you do find a little bit of sympathy for him throughout the movies and the books, you know. Definitely the movies.
Well, it's fitting. It's fitting because the pity of Bilbo is Gandalf says in the first movie, the pity of Bilbo may rule the fate of men. You know, the pity of Bilbo, because Frodo says the pity Bilbo didn't kill Gollum when he had the chance, back when Gollum's first following them in the Mines of Moria. And Gandalf says it was pity that stayed Bilbo's hand, and the pity may rule the fate of men. So it's very fitting that they really build in the pitifulness of Gollum, and that Frodo even starts to pity
him. Yeah, foreshadowing too. A little bit of foreshadowing, but I mean, even Frodo's pity towards Gollum kind of determines the fate, because we'll get to that.
Even Sam's to an extent. As much as Sam can't stand Gollum and Smeagol, and as much as he just doesn't trust him, I was reading this in the book because I was kind of like just trying to compare, and they're at the end whenever they're running up the mountain, Sam has Gollum dead to rights. Frodo's running up to go destroy the ring, hopefully, and Sam's looking at Gollum, and Gollum, you know, just says, you know, don't kill me, I'm just pitiful, to, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And Sam pities him, just like Frodo did, just like Bilbo did, and you know, that's very very important. But we'll get to that. But yeah, so it the ship for Gollum to be have a redemption arc sails when, in a moment of very hard, Frodo being put in a very hard spot with the Faramir and his Rangers, don't say there's a, you know, they're gonna have to kill Gollum, and Frodo says, "I'll lead you down to them, just don't kill him." Gollum doesn't understand what's going on. All he sees is betrayal, which allows his other persona, Sméagol, sees betrayal, and which allows Gollum to swoop back in and say, "See, I told you they would trick you. I told you they'd lie to you." You know,
which once again is another act of pity on Frodo. Instead of just letting Gollum get killed, he,
which that always bugs me when I'm in the movies, not in a annoyed way, but like, mm-hmm. just like, no, he was actually trying to save your life.
I know, like, if you, you know, yeah. Me. But yeah, that's what power does. That's what corruption does. Makes you believe things that aren't true, aren't real, especially when you don't understand the whole story, jumping to conclusions.
Yeah, all he knew, you know, I mean, all he knew was betrayal.
Yeah.
For so long, and he expected people to. He knew he was a kind of a hateful creature, and he just expected people to hate him.
It also didn't help, you know, too, that I mean, like, yeah, I think in his mind he was full for the most part of it up until his sort of redemption. He was planning on betraying them.
Oh yeah.
You know, so then it's almost like common nature for him to just, now they just betray
assume
him.
That, yeah, assumes I'm going to be betrayed because I'm planning on betraying
them. And then as soon as something looks like it, he's like, oh, well, they betrayed me. And then Gollum takes back over.
Yeah. Well, so in Return of the King, I don't really have much pity for Gollum at all in Return of the King because he's gone full on, I'm going to betray them. Even Sméagol is talking about, you know, is giddy at the chance to get the ring back. Mm-hmm. You know, he's fully on board with the plan to...
Not only that, but you start off with that initial scene of actually seeing how Sméagol got the ring, and you kind of start to lose pity for him then.
Right.
To an extent. I mean, you understand. I mean, like, once again, it's the ring's fault, it's the ring's power, but, I mean, he just straight up murders his friend.
There's something there, I think. Obviously, there is a corrupting power of the ring. I don't know, you know, is the ring exerting its influence? Like, did the ring just turn up the influence to 11 right then and there? Or is it that there was something within Gollum or Sméagol that he was so immediately consumed by it, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas you have Bilbo finds it. He's not trying to murder someone immediately.
And Frodo's not trying to murder someone.
Frodo's not trying, you know, I mean...
No one who necessarily holds the ring is trying to just murder someone immediately.
And Bilbo, Sméagol didn't even have it. He saw Deagle with it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like someone was trying to take it away from him. He was trying to take away from Deagle.
That's true. That's true. There's probably something in there already that the ring was able to grasp onto.
Yeah.
And
I think there was. I think that he already was kind of a character that was on the fringes.
Yeah.
Of his little circle of, you know,
I do like that his friend's name is Deagle. Sméagol and Deagle.
Sméagol and Deagle, yeah, they just didn't have a lot of...
It was literally like the movie, whoever made the name was just like, oh gosh, Sméagol.
Well, that's in the book too, so it's Tolkien.
Tolkien's just like, Sméagol. He's like, I've already made a whole language, just Deagle it is.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so...
It is kind of interesting how, like, at the end of The Two Towers, you do kind of have that sympathy for Sméagol.
Mm.
And he like you said, initially he kind of got rid of that Gollum persona, and then that betrayal kind of pushed back into it. But then it's almost interesting that they immediately, at least in the movies, immediately pushes back into the first scene is showing Sméagol killing Deagle for the ring. Yeah. You know, and it kind of almost immediately takes that sympathy away. And then you start to just see even more, and you're like, okay, I have zero sympathy for you now. You know, Gollum.
Well, you know, I think that was a big part of... You remember in The Fellowship of the Ring, Gandalf says that Sméagol hates and loves the ring as he hates and loves himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in The Hobbit, he calls it his birthday present.
Mm.
And it's all, and Gandalf says this in the books too, it's all, there's this guilt. He doesn't want to admit that he murdered his cousin for it. He's trying to, like, kind of reinvent how he got the ring, that it was his birthday present.
Mm.
And justify, or at least justify why he should have gotten it because it was his birthday. Even like he does in the scene, he's like, "It's my birthday, and I want it, so give it to me." And I think that's really part of where that Gollum persona comes from, is loneliness and guilt. He's lonely and he feels guilty, and he doesn't want to admit that guilt. And so out of it comes this, you know, other persona.
But then throughout all this as well, you have Sam and Frodo, and Sam plus Sam. I love him throughout all three movies. I love him a lot in the Return of the King. But you even have Frodo, from the first scene they show Frodo, you can already see that the ring is just getting more and more into him. And it's affecting him more and more. You can see it in his eyes. You can see, I mean, they the movie itself portrayed him very well. Yeah. I think them worn down, beaten down. He's even got like the red scar marks from the necklace from the ring hanging down.
Yeah, the weight of it. Like a physical weight to it.
And it's such detail that I love. And just how Frodo acts and everything like that. I mean, it really just shows the weight that Frodo's carrying and how the influence of the ring actually does have on him.
Yeah.
I mean, the friendship of Sam to just like constantly have an uplifting spirit almost the entire movie. In going into Mordor, he's like, you know, despite doing all things, he still almost seems to be uplifting. Sam's definitely one of my favorite characters.
Sam, I mean, you know, yes, Frodo's burden was beyond what Sam could understand, not having had to bear it that whole way, and what it was doing to Frodo and how it was altering his perception of things and messing with his mind and all that. But Sam's carrying a burden too. He's, you know, and you start to see it in the Two Towers, especially in the Fellowship of the Ring. He wants to come with Frodo because he wants to help him. He wants to be there for him. And then as the movies go on, you see he starts to realize this burden, how it's changing his master, what it's doing to him, and he can't help him.
He can't stop
what's happening. All he can do is try to be there, be faithful, be a friend, which is great. It's what Frodo needed.
A faithful friend, a friend who's not going to leave at the slightest hint of
because
whatever.
Ultimately, what was happening to him, there was no avoiding. The ring has a will of its own. It's trying to survive, and it wants to get back to Sauron, and it's just constantly manipulating and messing with people. Like if you have the ring, it's constantly trying to play on whatever it can to get you towards whatever it wants.
And I think it's very interesting with Sam too. It's almost just like, it almost seems like, at least up until pretty much the end of the Return of the King, it still almost seems like Sam doesn't fully understand the weight of everything going on.
Yeah.
Like, he does, but he does at the same time. Like, because, you know, he's talking about, like, we need to have enough for the return journey.
Yeah, and Frodo just looks at him like,
you know, it's just like, you throw out all this. Yeah. Like I said, even the uplifting spirit, I almost think is a sense of, yes, being uplifting, but also just, like, not fully understanding the gravity of what's happening. Not a bad way.
Right.
You know, up and until that pretty much near the end where he's just like, and that, you know, I don't know. I love Sam's character, especially throughout the Return of the King. A lot happens with Sam's character in Return of the King.
Yeah. Things are like, for Sam, things just slowly are slipping away. It's you're very right. Like, he wants to just get the mission over and get back to the Shire and everything go back to the way it was. And see Mary Rosie Cotton and, you know, have things be like they were, you know, and save the Shire. And the further things go, you know, he sees Gollum, what's happening with him, and he can't get Frodo to realize it. And I think Frodo knows to a certain extent, like, no, I shouldn't trust Gollum. I can't completely trust Gollum, but we can't just send him away.
Yeah.
We can't just lose him. We need our guide.
And pity, once again.
Right, and he's...
They need a guide, but he is starting
to believe that Sméagol can be saved, yeah.
I think part of that, too, is because, I mean, if you think about it, he probably... Because he does want to believe that Gollum can be saved as well, and part of that is probably because he's so influenced by the ring, too, he wants to believe that he can be saved.
Right.
That he can be brought back.
He sees himself
Gollum. He definitely sees himself in Gollum. And you definitely notice that in how he interacts with Gollum, and with Sam, how Sam interacts with Gollum, and how Frodo interacts with both of them interacting.
Yeah.
because I mean, almost throughout all the entirety of the movies with Gollum and Frodo and Sam is not trusting of Gollum at all.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting too, thinking about this whole dynamic of Frodo, Sam, Gollum, and think about people who carry burdens, who have walked through hard things, right? And you can have all the support and love around you, and you can still feel alone.
Absolutely.
Because you feel like people don't know what you're going through. You feel like people can't relate. They'd say that they feel bad or whatever. They try to relate, and just knowing that they haven't been through that, it can be hard for people to...
That, and your mind is clouded by circumstance.
Right.
You know, your mind, when you have these things going on, your mind is going to be clouded. Right. You're going to feel alone. Even if you can have someone come to you and literally be like, I know exactly how you're feeling, you're still going to feel alone.
Right.
To an extent, you know, I mean, you can be brought out of it, but if you're deep in it.
Makes me think, but then if you have someone who has been through the exact, if you hear someone start talking about they've been through the same thing, and they start talking about it, and it starts to resonate, it can, that person, people will latch onto mm-hmm. that person, mm-hmm. and even though that person may not have been there for them like other people, shown love for them like other people, but just there's that connection there that people want when they're going through hard stuff. It actually makes me think of Kaladin in Rhythm of War, when he finds the people that are like having, basically have depression, and they just put them up in this one part of the tower where there's no light. Because they try to keep them, because anything stimulating them will make them, upsets them more and all this stuff, which they're actually making them worse. And he starts to talk to that one guy, and he just basically says what that guy feels.
Mm.
And whenever he says that, it kind of makes the guy realize, like, I'm not alone. I think Frodo wants that. Unfortunately, all he can get out in Mordor is Gollum.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of what's going on a little bit. Too, you know, it's just, you know, Gollum has been in some way, he's felt what Frodo's felt.
Yeah.
You know. But, so what do you think about, if I'm not skipping anything, what do you think about the whole thing with Frodo sending Sam away? How do you feel about that?
It breaks my heart every time.
Yeah.
Oh, it absolutely breaks my heart. I don't know. It's one of those things where like, it irritates you because you're like, you know that Frodo's wrong. So you're like, Frodo, why? Like, why are you doing this?
Right.
But it's just, he's being corrupted by the ring. His judgment is being clouded by the ring. They're so close now, which means it's even going to be getting even worse. And he just makes a bad decision.
Yeah.
It's horribly sad. In my opinion.
Yeah.
But it shows that, like, even, I don't know, that scene just always breaks my heart every time. Because Sam has been such a loyal friend, and Sam has always tried to do his best for Frodo. And then to have Frodo just kind of throw him aside as soon as whatever. At the word of Gollum, nonetheless.
I said, whenever I was watching this with my wife, I was like, the greatest oversimplification in all of like cinema for Frodo to just be like, go home.
Yeah.
It's like,
do you realize where we're at, right?
You realize how far I've traveled and you're just like, go home, you know? But, my wife said, when I said, she said, one does not simply go home, which I wrote down because it cracked me up.
Oh, that's funny.
Which is true. It's like, one, you can't just tell Sam to go home.
Like, do you not realize?
You know, all the trouble he went through to like get through here and to not die here and all this stuff. And like to get through the dead marshes and all that. It's like, he can't just go home.
It really makes you think too. Like, what was Sam? I mean, what was Frodo thinking in that moment? Because like, what? It happened because Gollum threw the bread over the edge, sprinkled some crumbs on Sam, and
Sam was he actually thinking that Sam was actually stuffing
like,
his face?
Throughout this entire trip, where like literally Sam is just like, no, Master Frodo, you eat. I'm okay.
Yeah, right.
And then all of a sudden he's gonna pee out on all of the bread.
Just one night.
He like, and I get that he's like, the ring is corrupting his mind and he's not thinking straight, but like, come on now.
Like, yeah, it's one of those scenes, and I mean, there you can do this with lots of movies. I mean, like, when you take a scene and you just, like, pick it apart, you can pick apart lots of stuff, but this is one that it's almost easy to pick apart, like, right away. But here's another thing. Here's, like, a kind of an advocating for how what happens a little more. So one thing I was reading when I was reading the book, some parts of the book near the end, to see how the book characterized things near the end of their journey. One thing that was really interesting is how the ring, like, messed with your mind and, like, would make you see things and think things were going on that you that weren't going on. It would, like, you'd have, like, hallucinate things. So, for example, Frodo, when he's in the tower of Cirith Ungol, and Sam tells him, I took the ring because I thought you were dead, you know, and then Frodo's like, Frodo kind of loses it for a second because he realizes someone else has the ring, and he just wants it back, and he's like, give it back. He said, it says, I don't remember if it was Sam or Frodo, but they looked at, they saw, I think it was Frodo, Sam appeared as, like, an orc. He, like through Frodo's eyes, Sam looked like he was an orc, like, pawing at, and, like, getting ready to whip him, you know, which could have been some PTSD, but it's also just the ring's influence. And I think Sam had a similar thing where he was, like, Frodo looked like, you know, something, some horrible creature or something. So the ring can actually, in a critical moment of temptation, can make you see something, like, completely different than what's actually happening. And so you could argue, like, and it kind of, the way they shoot that scene where Sam starts talking and Frodo's like, like, his eyes are, like, zooming in on Sam's lips, and Sam's like, I could carry it for a while, you know, share the load, you know, it's really showing that, like, Frodo, what Frodo's seeing and what he's getting is, which I don't really think that, you know, like, Frodo wasn't sending him away because of the crumbs or anything.
Yeah, I know.
He was sending him away because he saw a threat to the ring.
Yeah.
Sam wants it. He's going to take it from me. And he, and I think the ring really was playing with his mind. And he, you know, so you could argue that Frodo had Frodo had very little capacity to think very logically.
Yeah, that's very
because
true.
Of what the ring was the pressure of the ring was constantly putting on his mind, you know. And I think that you can see they try to show that in the movie, like, there's just this constant haze, kind of fog that Frodo seems like he's in.
Yeah, they did a really good job with that, making it look like that.
Until he gets to the, you know, top of the tower, the top of the stairs, and he's like, it kind of hits him.
It's interesting too, that scene. It almost seems like walking into that almost clears his mind for some reason.
Jerks him out of it, yeah.
He's just like, wait a minute. Like, this is not good. He even says, like, you know, Frodo, you fool, or something like that, sending Sam away.
Yeah. He says, listen, I'm so sorry, Sam. Yeah.
You know, and then, gosh, freaking ever loyal Sam is crying, climbing down the stairs, sees the breadcrumbs, and it's just like, no, I'm not going to let my friend just send me away. He needs me, and goes back up like a boss. Into who knows what, you know, because he knows something's going on.
Yeah, Sam turns into, this is where Sam really, I mean, Sam was a very heroic character already, just his loyalty, his friendship, but he, it's almost like his loyalty and his friendship at this point become these tangible, they like become these tangible skills that actually propel him into being a friggin' warrior.
I think this moment, you know, too, is really where Sam breaks out of that thought of, I think this moment is when he really understands what's at stake, what's going on. He has seen Frodo's officially kind of,
right.
At that moment, right. At that moment, has officially kind of lost it, sent him away, knowing that he didn't do anything, you know, and he realizes, like, oh, there's a lot more at stake. And instead of slinking back and running away, he runs headfirst into it, and that shows true courage and true hero.
That's a really good thought too, because if you think about it, up until this point, Sam, he helps Frodo, but he really kind of lets Frodo take the lead. And at this point in the movie and in a lot of ways in the book, he kind of realizes, if we're gonna complete this mission, if we're gonna survive, if I don't want him to die, I'm just gonna have to take charge.
But not only that too, I mean, you think about it, because in a few scenes later, and a little bit later on, like, I think the weight of what they're doing is fully hit him. Of, like, they're here to destroy the ring for the sake of Middle Earth. Because you even think, there's a point, I think, I don't remember when it is, whether they're walking up the mountain or not. Frodo says something about the return journey, and Sam, that's when Sam turns corners and goes, I don't think there is a return journey.
Right. Well, yes. You
know, he's officially made that turn where, like, right. He understands the weight of this, and he knows that it still needs to be completed, because it's not just their lives at stake, it's everyone's lives. Those are the Shire, those are their friends. You know, he has this change where he's like, he understands now, like, we're not just doing this for whatever. This is serious stuff, you know? And I don't know, I like seeing that change. And then he really comes into his hero, where he really becomes the hero. And like I said, the leader, where he takes charge, he rushes in, he freaking full on goes 1-to-1 with Shelob. Is that her name?
Yeah.
The giant spider that I would crack my pants and run away from seeing. I could barely watch the scene without crying. I hate spiders so much.
So did Peter Jackson, apparently. And he made the design the spider as scary as possible.
It's his fault. So, like, but and just sitting there fighting it, like, just straight up, like.
Yeah.
And then not only that, but then following the orcs to the tower. And then, despite there being, like, a massacre of all them all massacring each other, still going in there and, you know, run and train on the orcs that are still alive. You know, this is for Frodo. This is for the Shire.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like he is really at this point. I mean, his mind almost seems to have switched. He's gotten very.
Switches flipped whenever he.
He fully takes the lead. He's fully like, I my mind is set now. I know what we're doing and we're going to get it done.
Yeah.
To the point where he hands it back to Frodo. And then you even get the moment on the mountain, which is such a great scene where Frodo collapses and he goes, I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you.
Right.
Picks him up and starts walking up the mountain. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, he takes the lead.
Can't carry the ring, but I can carry the one carrying the ring.
I know. I was talking about it with my wife too. I was just like, I get it. I was like, but just think, if he just picked up the ring, so much lighter than Frodo.
Or is it?
Maybe physically it is, but mentally.
I think at that point you couldn't have taken the ring away from Frodo. It would have broke his brain.
Mm-hmm.
He would have lost his mind. I just think one thing I think is really cool about the Shelob fight I was thinking about is the sword Sting got its name in The Hobbit, killing giant spiders that are probably like
close relatives.
Relatives of Shelob, maybe her children, I don't know. But like Bilbo was fighting the spiders, and when he had the ring on, he could understand them, and they said it stings, and so he named it Sting, and now he's fighting the mother of these spiders.
Now I'm curious
with the same sword.
Now I'm curious if one of them put on the ring, if they'd be able to understand Shelob.
Interesting. Maybe. If you were going to be...
Because she's also an extremely old character.
Very old, yeah. From Ungoliant, her mother was the one who ate the two trees of Valinor that gave light to all of Middle-earth.
Nice. Man, that must have been delicious.
Not enough. But yeah, so that scene is just really cool from that perspective.
I never really thought about that. That's interesting.
You know, going back to, we talked about like D&D roles.
Mm-hmm.
Sam's rolling a lot of critical roles in this fight.
Either that or the spider's rolling a lot of
critical misses.
Critical fails.
Yeah, the spider's rolling ones. Because, I mean, he's rolling out of the way of a giant friggin'...
Especially for someone who has never fought before. Like, yeah, he is.
Definitely never fought a giant spider before.
Let alone much of anything else.
It's just crazy.
You're right, though. That's funny. I think this is the exact opposite, where you have, instead of Legolas rolling a bunch of nat 20s, you have Shelob rolling a bunch of nat 1s.
That's true, because even in, like, the book, I think that when... She basically, like, at one point, Shelob, like, is going down to attack, and just... Sam's just holding the sword up, and the sword, and she just like plants herself on the sword.
That was the fourth nat one in a row, and the team was finally just like, all right, you are going to get punished.
Yeah. You get stabbed in the organs.
The thorax. Your spider thorax.
Your thorax has been critically damaged. But yeah, so that's just I just love that entrance. That entrance is just one of the most epic entrances in all of cinema. Just Sam's hand with a sword coming into shot with Frodo being wrapped up by the spider. It's just like, you just know Frodo's going to be okay because Sam's there.
Then you have like that heartbreaking moment, though, where just like Sam goes, dead. Horrible. No, Master Frodo, you know. And then you have the orcs come in. And just, I love that shot of Sam just like, Sam, you fool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he knows he messed up to an extent. Like, I mean, it's not really much he could have done, but
yeah,
you know. And then you have the scene of him running to the tower.
Charging
the orcs. I love just, this is for Frodo. This is for the Shire.
And
this
is for my Sam has some great one-liners at the end. Like he gets all the good one-liners in this part of the movie. And I love the line when he gets to the top of the ladder, that one orc's like telling Frodo to be quiet or he'll stick him like a pig. And Sam just like a sword, his sword just bursts through that. Not if I stick you first.
Yeah, and you see the blue. Gosh, I love it. Sam's great. I do like that. I do, in the movie specifically, I like the scene though where Frodo's like, it's over, he has the ring, and Sam's like, you know, I'm sorry, you know, you're mistaken, I you know, thought you were dead. And then Frodo asks for the ring, and you kind of, the movie, I think Sam, I like it, has... I don't know if they do it in the book, but the movie is like he almost like takes,
they focus more on Sam having a little bit of whatever.
Yeah. And I like that because it shows that even Sam, despite a lot of everything, is not perfect, and the ring has influence on him too.
Yeah. That's very important.
I think that's such an important aspect of the entire story in general.
Yeah.
Is that like nobody is perfect, and that this ring has the power to draw anybody and to you know, warp anyone's mind. No one's immune. You know, because sometimes you have stories where you have the chosen one who is completely whatever, and he can, you know, whatever, and all that good stuff.
It's not about, you know, the one who can't be tempted. Yeah, the temptation just has no pull to them. The temptation does have pull.
They're resisting that temptation.
They go as far as they can. Mm-hmm. And even getting close to the end here, we can just get there. You know, they get up into Frodo has like a burst of energy all of a sudden when Gollum shows up, and he runs all the way up ahead of Sam.
Yeah, poor Sam just had to
fight off Gollum by himself.
No, he had to crawl all the way up the mountain with Frodo on his back, and all of a sudden Frodo's like, "Whoa, like,
sprint!"
I'm up.
Yeah,
Sam just like,
what? Frodo has his second wind.
Yeah. I guess imagine Sam just being like, "Really, dude? Really?
You could have just run the whole time.
Like you have this energy in you. Yeah, now he's got to fight off, you know,
and then he's got to fight off Smeagol." And everything, but
Smeagol fights dirty.
Frodo reaches his limit.
Mm.
Frodo reaches his cap on resisting this. He's been resisting it the whole way, and in the place that it was made, its peak power, it takes him.
Mm.
The ring takes him, and Sam can just, all he can do is watch in horror. You know, his nightmare is coming true.
The ring is mine.
Yeah, Frodo's claimed the ring, puts it on like a psycho in Mount Doom. You know, all the ring race that are fighting the eagles back at the Black Gate just lose their minds, like, oh my gosh, you know,
he's here.
I think the movie even shows like Sauron's eye, like panic mode, like zooms in on, you know, and even like the book talks about in that moment, like Sauron is just like,
oh crap.
Like, yeah, it just never entered into his wild imagination that someone would try and take the ring and destroy it. Like the ring, the hold the ring had on people and the temptation it had, he always believed someone would try to rival him. Someone would try to take it up and use its power to rival him, like Gandalf or Aragorn or something like that. And so that's why he was focusing all his...
I actually wouldn't be surprised if in that moment he thought Aragorn had the ring.
Right.
Like, I really, it wouldn't surprise me at all if he thought that.
Like, that Aragorn had the ring, maybe, at the Black Gate.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And, the pity of Bilbo comes full circle when Gollum himself, Sam comes to from getting hit in the back of the head, and by Gollum, and Gollum's riding Frodo like he's playing chicken, like on his, like
that is such a funny scene.
How did he like climb up him? But
then he just bites that finger off. Oof, yummy.
But he does spit the finger out. Let it be known, he's not a cannibal.
He's a baby. Come on, if you're gonna bite a finger off, you gotta go big. Take it all away. Just commit to eat that thing. If you're gonna bite one off, might as well just commit.
Yeah. So,
but this scene right here too is like, and the more I've thought about it, especially after watching it again and watching some videos like that, like this scene is such a good scene because it almost brings together everything that Tolkien was kind of part of what I think he was trying to get at in the story. There is kind of like a subversion of what you think is going to happen. You know, you assume in stories like this that good guy's going to throw the ring in the lava, he's going to win. But he doesn't. Frodo doesn't do it. Frodo goes, I know the ring's mine. I take the ring as my own. That hero just basically got to the very end and said, nope, it's mine. Frodo failed. Frodo never actually succeeded in his quest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I love that because it shows, and you know, obviously we know Tolkien was a Christian and had those beliefs, and obviously he wrote that into a story. You know, this really shows that, like, despite anything we do, you know, we're gonna fail, or we can't. We have that, you know, despite how hard we try to do the right thing, we can fail. But then you also have, once again, the pity, like you said, the pity of Bilbo with Gollum or Sméagol. You know, that what the objective was, what was supposed to happen, still occurred. But it wasn't due to anything that Frodo as a person did or Sam as a person did. I mean, yeah, they got it to Mount Doom, but ultimately, like, without, he still failed, you know? But the ring still was destroyed.
There's a term that Tolkien coined for this phenomenon, especially in fantasy stories, which he said was a key component to true fantasy stories, is the term is eucatastrophe. And it means good catastrophe.
Mm.
And he says it's the sudden turn, the sudden unexpected turn. Not the expected, you know, people expect good to win.
Mm-hmm.
But in the moment of this this utter failure, the person who was supposed to destroy the ring has become completely given over to it. The person who wants the ring, who's this very already completely corrupted, has it. The ring wraiths are closing in. All the attention is now in the place they don't want it. And in the book, Gollum's foot just slips, you know, and he falls. I don't mind the way they do it in the movie either. Yeah. They still both, Gollum still slips. It's somewhat due to, you know, them both fighting over the ring. But at the same time, the ring was not destroyed by any one person's intention. It was only destroyed by the intention of a higher good.
Yeah.
You know, which is a great, which is what the idea of the eucatastrophe is that grace comes when there's no expectation or reason to expect it.
Mm.
You know, at the depth of your failure, you know, at the bottom of the pit, grace comes. What? Light comes, hope comes.
Mm.
You know, when everything just keeps getting darker and darker and darker, things turn around all of a sudden. That's not where you would expect things to go if you're living through that. You know, we expect it. We sort of expect it in these types of stories, but I think that's because that is a feature of the way our creator has built into stories. We expect something good to happen.
Mm.
But it's not a given that it's going to happen. It's not deserved. Mm. It's not earned. It's, you know, pure grace. And and the scene, I love this. It's not in the book, but I love it. And I prefer it. That Frodo is dangling by one hand.
Yes.
And he's broken.
Mm.
He knows he's failed. The ring has been taken from him. which probably he doesn't feel the relief of that in that moment. Mm-hmm. It's not till after they run out of the volcano that he feels the relief of that. So he feels utterly lost.
Yes.
And all he'd have to do is just let go.
Mm.
But Sam is there.
Mm.
And Sam just looks at him, and I just love that Sam says this. He just says, "Don't you let go. Don't let go. Reach." You know, Sam is just, you know, he may not. That's the moment when you do need someone.
Yes.
You do need someone that hasn't, this may not have been where you're at.
Well, man, he's almost even, you know, thinking on it now. I mean, like, in a minor role, Sam's almost kind of taking on that, almost like that Christ-like persona of, like, you're on that cliff, you're hanging on the edge, and you're ready to let go. And then, you know, when you're at your deepest, darkest point, then you have Christ reach down and say, "Don't let go," you know?
And actually it grabs you and pulls you
up. Yeah, not only that, but grabs you and pulls you up, you know?
Even if you would try to, which I think Sam would have totally done.
Absolutely.
Sam would have gone over the edge trying to grab Frodo if he tried to let go.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, but also just shows, like, in a more mundane sense, like, it shows just, once again, the friendship of Sam. That, like, he watched his friend, who sent him away not too long ago, then he saved him, carried him up a mountain, got to this point. Then Frodo goes, "No, the ring's mine. After all forget this journey, you. Forget you, the ring is mine," despite what we just went through. And then, even after all of that, Sam still goes over the edge and goes, "Don't you let go."
Yeah.
Like, man, that's, you know.
Heavy. Yeah, that's probably my favorite scene in the whole trilogy.
It is up there.
That, and I mean, it's a quick thing, but that moment, maybe my favorite moment, you know, because it's not a full scene, really.
It's definitely one of my favorite moments up, like,
that's one of my moments that I get a little misty, if not overtly misty.
And by overly misty, you mean full on crying?
But just think about going back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, seeing someone carrying a burden and you want to carry it for them, but you can't.
Mm.
All you can do is just try to be there for them, you know? And you want to say to them, "Don't let go." You know, you want to be able to pull them back from the brink.
Mm.
You know, maybe they're there, maybe they're not there, you don't know. But if they are there, you want to be able to say that to them. You want them to hear someone say, "Don't let go."
I'll tell you, I mean, you know, and this is getting a little bit more, probably a little bit more real than we made, than whatever, but, like, even recently, and I was with this person for like 10 minutes because my partner sounded back with him. We had a call, man. It was to a guy's house for unresponsive patient. Everyone on this podcast should know I'm pretty sure they all know I work with an ambulance service. But I mean, this guy was, I mean, excuse my language, but he was pissed drunk.
Mm-hmm.
We woke him up and everything like that. And we're like, my partner looked at him and said, "Hey, man, what's going on? Why are you drinking?" You know, this guy had just had medical procedures done. He goes, didn't really answer. So just started crying. My partner goes, "Like, are you trying to hurt yourself?" And then he goes, "No." He goes, "You're just trying to, like, forget." The guy kind of, like, nodded his head yes and was, like, crying. He's like, "Look, man," kind of like the same thing. It's just, like, don't keep fighting, keep pushing. And my partner, I appreciate my partner for this. He stood up and he helped the guy. This guy was not dressed. We helped dress him. We got very personal with him and said, "Look, man, I know it's struggle. I know you're struggling with depression right now and everything like that, but man, push through it." And then not only that, but, like, this is why I got off late on Monday. This is why we're doing the podcast now. That call was at 10 minutes before I got off shift. And we could have easily taken him to the closest hospital, which was 5 minutes away. But my partner, and I agree with him, was like, "No, we need to take him to the hospital." It was about 25 minute drive. He said, "We need to take him there because those are the people that are going to help him. This other hospital cannot help him. These people have a psych unit there. They have psychiatrists there that'll help him with his problem." You know, and it's kind of like that, even that moment, just like, don't let go. You're struggling and you're in a bad spot, but don't let go. Sometimes you need that person. Just be like, you need that one person, even if it's someone you've never met before that is from an ambulance that's picking you up.
Sometimes it's better.
Yeah, just say, "Hey, man, don't let go, man."
Yeah.
You know, "I know you're struggling. Don't let go." And I don't think that guy said a single word to us.
Yeah.
Mind you. I mean, I'm sure he could talk. And it wasn't, we didn't have a problem. We got the information we needed from him to do our stuff. But we tried our best to take care of him, make him comfortable, and get him to the place that he needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Despite, you know, we got off, like I said, like, I think we got off like an hour and a half late that day, or an hour late, because we had to drive pretty far. But it was what this guy needed.
Yeah.
You know? And sometimes you need to do that. And you want, and I would hope that if I'm ever in that situation, which I hope I'm not, but that I would have someone, whether it's you or someone else, just be like, hey man, don't let go.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I, and to an extent I have. I've had a friend who's, I've been in a tough spot in my, in a slightly less serious situation. My friend's like, hey man, don't let go. I'm gonna stay here with you. We're gonna get you up. We're gonna get you doing stuff. Mm. You know, kind of the same concept.
I mean, I think in those moments, the hard part for that person or for yourself, if you're the one going through it, is you can't see past that moment.
You absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can't see past that moment, or you just know this moment will come again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I will be here in this hard place again that I don't want to go forward. And but at the same time, the what you can't see in that moment is there will be other moments that you'll be glad, you know, that you did keep going.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be moments that you can, that just, if you can just push back past. And that's why you need someone like a Sam. You need someone who,
absolutely,
that's why it's better. Sometimes you do need that person that's outside of that
mm-hmm.
that doesn't know what you're going mm-hmm. through, but maybe they're a little bit naive, and they're just there to say,
they're willing to sit there and just say,
I'm not where you're at right yeah. now, and I'm saying you can be here.
Mm-hmm.
This is where you could be, and so you might as well
absolutely
push past this moment and get on to the next one, get on to a better one. You know,
we should all aspire to be a Sam.
Yeah, absolutely.
If ever, you know, be that friend, be that person that's not gonna, despite everything, even if you were hurt, you know, don't.
Yeah.
Don't let go.
Yeah, don't let go, guys.
Let it go. I mean, don't let it go.
Sam, thankfully, Frodo does not let go.
Yes, and he reaches.
He reaches.
Just the scene. Reach. The bloody hand. I'm like, ugh.
The bloody stump of a finger.
Yeah, that probably hurts.
Yeah. They run from lava.
To make it a little more lighthearted, this, every time I watch this movie, this scene, funniest memory of my life for this movie is we're in the theaters watching this, me, my mom, my dad, my brother. And you have the scene. Mind you, my mom's never read the books. You know, this movie had just come out, so she didn't know exactly what was going to happen. My dad's obviously read the books. Yeah. You know, everything like that. And I just remember we're in the theater, and they are on the rock with the lava around them. And you know how the scene, like, it cuts to black? And it cuts to black for like a solid 5 seconds.
Yeah.
It was long enough for my mom to go, what? That's it? Like really loud in the theater. And then it cuts back and she's like, oh! and it just, the scene, and that, every time I see the scene, I think of that. It makes me laugh every time. Oh.
When I was in the theater, I saw it at midnight
mm-hmm.
showing. Did you guys see it at the midnight
no,
showing?
No, I was young. I was young at this point, man. This was back in, like, what, 2000 something?
2003.
Yeah, I was young, dude. I was like, oh gosh.
Two?
I'm about to date myself. I'm not that young, jeez. I was like, man, wow, I was young. I must have been really young.
I was 13.
You came out in 2003?
Yeah. December, I think, 2003. So I was 13.
That would have made me six.
Man.
I saw that movie at six in the theaters? There's no way.
Yeah, it was totally 2003.
Yeah, I'm
go I mean, ahead.
You might be right.
Go ahead.
Maybe I made this entire
challenge.
I might have made this entire memory up.
You may no, have
I don't,
made.
What I don't
you,
think so.
What do you have the ring missing with your mind?
I mean, I have a lot of things missing with my mind, probably.
Well, so when I was in the theater,
oh my gosh, you're right.
At the midnight showing, there's a lot of endings to this movie.
It made $1.146 billion in the box office.
Yeah.
December 17th, 2003.
I wonder what the next movie to make that much money at the box office will be, with the way the movie industry is, like movie theaters and stuff. And they're like, because of COVID and stuff.
Oh yeah,
people aren't going as much. They're also releasing things out to other platforms, so people are like, oh, just stay home and watch it.
That's I miss movie theaters, man. I haven't been to a movie in a while.
Anyway, but so in the theater, all these endings happen, and then it fades to white. And then I think that's when it gets them back to Hobbiton,
probably,
because they do all these other endings. They do.
Or does it go to River Rivendell? I thought it faded to white into Rivendell, because then the white opens up to Frodo. Or maybe I'm thinking something else.
Maybe it does fade to white and go to Frodo, but then it also fades to white later, and then goes to them in the Shire. And some guy is like in the back, you know, goes, come on, you know, like he's like tired of all the endings. I'm just like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me right now? Like, this is a trilogy of movies. Like, we need some closure here.
I love it. That's hilarious.
We need to see that everyone's okay. But, yeah, so you get, they get the Eagles friggin' save the day again. They come. We'll need to talk about the Eagles at some point on a podcast.
I'm sure we will, yeah.
There's lots of thoughts about the Eagles.
The Eagles that could have done so much throughout the movies that didn't do anything throughout the movies.
They did a lot.
They did nothing important.
They fought the Ringwraith.
They could have done this.
They saved Frodo and Sam.
Why didn't they bring them? No, I'm just playing.
See, that's why we need to talk about this. Because it's very controversial. And yeah. But anyway, so they get back. You get that awesome, you know, sort of, it's like slow motion. Everybody's happy-go-lucky. So it's, I always get a little chuckly about it because mm-hmm. of seeing everybody in slow motion, like
reacting. I like it's such a happy
but it's a
scene.
Very
it's
a happy scene to see them all reunited,
you and know? Then oh man, gosh, and then until you see everyone's so happy seeing them reunited, and then Sam walks to the door, doesn't rush, yeah, and you just see Frodo and you just Sam with, yep, you know,
twinkle in his eye,
and Sam just stands there. But then we get to the coronation of the king.
Yes.
And this, teased from last episode, is where my favorite moment comes in.
You like the singing?
Yes, absolutely. Oh gosh, his Aragorn singing was so beautiful, and that scene actually makes me laugh a lot because he just starts singing, and I'm like, "What's happening? Like, you were just what?" but you have the coronation of the king, and he's walking through, and he sees his, you know, his love chick, whatever. That is, like, mentioned, like, three times in the movies, and it is what it is. She's
mentioned more in the movies than she is in the books.
I know. And she's not mentioned that much in the movies. But then you go, and you have this scene. And Aragorn and his new bride, or whatever, queen, go to and stand in front of Frodo, Sam, Merry, and Pippin. These four hobbits, the only four hobbits in this crowd of humans and probably a couple elves. And they bow out of respect to Aragorn and everything like that. And Aragorn, being the true, wonderful king that he is, just says, "My friends, you bow to no one." And then proceeds to bow to them. The king bows to them, and everyone else bows with them. Mm. And that, if you want to know what scene almost drives me to tears, it's that one right there. That is my favorite. I don't know why. Well, I mean, yeah. I do. It's just such a strong scene, in my opinion. It shows a lot about every single character in this movie, yeah, in my opinion. And Aragorn, which is probably my favorite character in the movie, it shows a lot about him. But just that you know, they all are like, we know what you guys have gone through. Yeah. Not we know, but we, you know, like, you guys have been through so much. Like, you saved, you four hobbits who no one has thought anything of, because no one in the rest of the, what, you know, Middle Earth has really thought much of hobbits.
Yeah.
Even throughout the movie, they say a lot of times, like, it's just, you know, something about hobbits of whatever. They like to sit in their holes and chill out.
They made their mark on Middle Earth.
And yeah.
For sure.
And you just have them, you know, just like, you know, you bow to no one. And the king bows, and they all bow with them. And these hobbits are just standing there, dumbfounded. And that scene, you know, almost drives me to tears every time. I love that scene.
There's a theme throughout the, like, books and movies of, like, people didn't know, like, a lot of people didn't even know hobbits existed. Like, even Treebeard didn't know hobbits existed. Mm-hmm. Like, Treebeard is supposedly one of the oldest, if not the oldest, creature, sentient creature in the world, and besides, like, the Valar and all those things. But he has all these songs about all these different creatures, and there's no songs for hobbits. But the world will never forget that there the existence of hobbits after this, you know, this whole ordeal. So it's definitely a great moment.
I love that.
Of recognition for them. I mean, think about Pippin. First of all, obviously, Pippin, we wouldn't be where we're at without Pippin. Because if Pippin didn't wake up the Balrog, Gandalf doesn't become Gandalf the White. Gandalf the White doesn't do all the things he does.
Oh my gosh.
So, like, right, you know, Pippin, but also Pippin saves Faramir. Like, if Pippin doesn't tell Gandalf Faramir's dying, there's no Faramir.
And then you have Merry, who kind of helped lead the Ents to war. Married.
Yeah, well, Mary...
Mary and Pippin, but Mary was very pivotal.
Mary and Pippin were very pivotal with the Ents, too.
Yeah, leading the Ents to war.
Yeah.
So, Mary specifically, Mary was very strong of, like, I mean, Pippin was kind of there, and he was definitely, like, about it, this but, world, yeah.
Yeah,
and, you know, he was very pivotal in that, and just the racking of...
Was it Gandalf said in Two Towers Asgard? That the arrival of Mary and Pippin will be, like, two small stones that start an avalanche or something like that? Which he was right. And then you have Mary has a hand in defeating the Witch King.
Yeah, that's very true.
And then obviously Frodo and Sam goes without saying.
Yeah.
What they accomplished, you know. So four hobbits.
Four hobbits.
What can four hobbits accomplish?
And it just shows you that no matter how small you think you are, you can do great things.
Even the smallest person can change the course of the future.
Exactly. Just like Yoda.
There you go. He had the Force on his side.
Yeah, he led the Jedi to destruction.
That's true. Another podcast. Fool of a Yoda.
Fool of a Duke.
But yeah, so then they make it back to the Shire. And all is well, right?
And the movie's all is well.
Well, yeah. But even in the movies, yes, in the book.
In the book, all is not necessarily well in the Shire.
Tolkien was very interested in showing how evil, when you go abroad to fight evil and you come home, that you may find some of the things you were fighting abroad have come home and changed the home that you love, which I think is a great thing to look at. It was hard for them, I think, to kind of ramp things back up for the movie, you know, in a movie, a very long movie, to ramp things back up for a whole other little arc.
It wouldn't have fit in the movie at all. The movie, I like the way the movie did too. They go back there. I like that scene where they're in the bar and like these four have just went through so much trauma
and nobody really
knows. Everyone's just living their life. And I also just love it too. We're just like, Sam is just like, puts his mug down, stands up, and goes over to the girl. Right, yeah. And you just see,
not wasting any more time.
The eyebrows raise from the other hobbits. Yeah. They start laughing. Frodo's laughing. It's just like one of those things, just like, man, it's...
They get a moment. They definitely get a moment of lifting the burden that they've all had been carrying. They're back home and, they get to have, you get to have a wedding, hobbit wedding. And
the kids.
Pippin catches the bouquet. But even though the Shire hasn't been messed up, it's still been messed up for Frodo.
Absolutely.
Frodo can't enjoy the Shire anymore. He can't rest anymore because of the burden he had to carry, the things he's seen, the things he's had to go through.
You probably have a good time with Caladan.
Yeah, probably. He says in the book that he says something about people have to go off and they have to give things up in order to save them.
Mm.
And that's a very, I think Tolkien being a survivor of World War I, a veteran of World War I, I should say, and a survivor, he fought in the Battle of the Somme. Which was like the bloodiest, most grueling battle of World War I. And everyone knows, I mean, World War I kind of has a reputation for being just a brutal fighting in the trenches.
Yeah.
Just, these no man's lands in between them that they have to charge through, where there's just mines and barbed wire and, rotting corpses and things like that. And in one of the most bloody ones, he survived. And people, soldiers that go off and fight a lot of times, and I don't have any grounds to really speak much on this, but it's, I think a theme I've picked up on and heard people talk about some, about how it's hard to come back from war and to see when you've seen the evil, the horrible things that you've had to do, the horrible things that you've seen happen to your friends. Just to come back and to try and
really kind of integrate back into society. Because I think, and I obviously don't know, I haven't felt gone this way because I've been to war or anything like that. I've been in the military, but like I've definitely read books. I've you know, talk to different people who have been, I've read different things about, you know, because I was going to go into the military at one point and read about these things and studied up and talked to different people. And I mean, there are even people, special forces guys too, who have like seen crappy of the crap, who have like, they don't want to come home. Some of them don't want to come home. Right. They're like, I want to stay. I want to go back for another tour. I want to go back. You know, I can't integrate back into society because I'm so far in depth in this, and this is, it has influenced my life so much in this way that like, really I can't just, come back. I don't know how to come back. Actually, a good example of that is the book and movie American Sniper.
Yeah.
Where he struggles with that. I mean, if you've ever seen it or read the book, I mean, he struggles with that a lot of coming back to his family and to his kids and to just
physically coming back. And, but mentally it's hard to come back. Mm-hmm.
And they do, I think they do a good job with that. I think you definitely kind of get that hit, that vibe from Frodo.
Yeah.
And it makes sense from everything that Frodo's gone through as well. I'm sure like even after the ring's gone, I'm sure he still to an extent feels
Something
was ripped away, you know, because he did. I mean, I think once again, at the end there, he fully gave in, you know, it fully took control, which means having that ripped away now, it's going to feel.
And that was that's a burden. You think about the ring as the burden, as a burden. But in the end, maybe the greatest burden that Frodo carried was what he was allowing the ring to do to himself. So that nobody else would have to bear that burden. So nobody else would have to have that ripped away, have the darkness poured into them and then ripped away.
Which, if you think about it too, going all the way back to Fellowship of the Ring, back before the party, the Fellowship even just went out, you know, when Frodo stands up and says, I'll take the ring. And you have that scene of Gandalf and he almost looks closes his eyes like this. I don't think, and a lot of people can see that. These see it like, oh, you know, he's about to go into danger, go to Mordor, and everything like that. It's like, no, I think Gandalf realizes like this is gonna have a toll on his on who he is. Not just going into Mordor, which sucks, but he's like, but I think Gandalf understands to an extent like this ring is gonna change him, and not for the better.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that is why his eyes are downcast in that scene. Why he is so troubled by this. He didn't want Frodo to have to deal with that.
Right. Yeah. Definitely. I wrote down, the burden is gone, but the scars remain. Yeah, he has that. He has the that he's like massaging the shoulder where he was stabbed by the Witch King or the Ringwraith stabbed him. It's been like, I forget how many years he said it had been, 3 years or something like that to the day.
I think it was 3 years to the day.
And every anniversary it hurts. And then he's got the ring finger that was bit off. He has these physical markers of what he went through that kind of remind you and remind him of what he's gone through, that like he even says, there are some hurts that go too deep. They've taken hold that he can't, he destroyed the ring, but the evidence of the burden and the horrible things he went through, he can never forget those things. He can never like completely come back from those things. He's a different person. He gave up who he was, you know, he gave up the innocence and all that to destroy the ring. And he came back as somebody who couldn't enjoy the Shire anymore. So, which, you know, yesterday was Hobbit Day.
Was it?
Hobbit Day is Frodo and Bilbo's birthday. It's also the same day that they went to they sailed west. It was on Bilbo's birth, you know. I think Bilbo says something about that, about how old he is. He just surpassed the old Took or something like that in his interesting age. And so while a lot of people were talking yesterday, a lot of like nerds were talking about, you know, happy birthday Frodo and Bilbo, there's a very symbolic date there as well to consider. It's the day that they left this world behind that gave them so much trouble, especially Frodo. You know, and went into the West, which was a land that was reserved for those who wanted to be free from the cares and the difficulties of Middle Earth. That's a tough scene.
That is a tough scene, especially with all the hobbits crying to like Merry and Pippin and Sam, you know.
Yeah, they don't get it. And Sam's just, you know, he's just beside himself. You know, he wanted to be able to save Frodo, and he still couldn't save him. You know, he saved him, but he wanted that to mean more than wanted them to be able to just be like old times, you know, grow old together. you know, raise families together and all that. But interesting too, Gandalf's leaving. I mean, Gandalf finished his job.
That's true.
He's going. He gets to rest. He gets rest from his weary journeys. The ring bearers, Galadriel and Elrond leave too, because their power is over. They don't like at least the power of the rings they have.
Yeah.
So their realms are going to start fading. That's a poignant scene. You know, it's got a mixture of emotion and just beauty. Is there any more that needs to be said about Return of the King?
Man, I don't think so. At least not right now.
Well,
this has been Return of the King. Lord of the Rings. Episode. This is the last Lord of the Rings episode for right now.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get back to, you know.
We'll come back to it at one point.
Yeah, when we have something to talk about, a topic, or maybe another Tolkien book or whatever.
Maybe we'll go back and have a conversation about some of the lore.
Yeah,
that takes place before the movies.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for, you know, joining us with it. I've really enjoyed watching all the movies again, especially the extended editions. That has been so much fun. My wife and I both have loved it. Given me a new desire to know more about Lord of the Rings than I do. Hope you guys have watched along as well, or have watched, and if you guys have enjoyed these conversations, these talks.
Yeah.
Liked our thoughts.
We're not done. We have more podcasts to share with you.
Oh, absolutely.
So please tune in next time. Tell your friends about us. Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll keep churning them out as we do.
So, Rennie,
this has been Bridge of Two Podcasts.
A far, far away bridge. Nailed it.
That song, Into the West, that gets me. The song that at the end, during the credits.
Oh.
What can you see on the horizon? I got a little off key there.
La la la.
There you go.